Good day and welcome to today's program. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. You may register to ask a question at any time during today's conference by pressing the star and 1 on your touchtone phone. We will take questions following the presentation. Please know that this call may be recorded. It is now my pleasure to turn over the program to Ms. Angela Kelly, the Director of the Immigration Policy Center. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank everybody for joining us for this timely briefing. As I'm sure everybody knows, the President said last month in a town hall meeting and spoke in some detail that he wanted to move immigration reform this year. That intention was reiterated last week in a New York Times article. And today's report and the panelists' discussion is a synthesis of government and academic data that examines the economic impact of reform. We would suggest that immigration is a low-hanging fruit for Congress that they can pluck as they consider steps for economic recovery. And we would put forward really three reasons for suggesting that reform and recovery go hand in hand. First, immigration reform generates revenue. The Congressional Budget Office scored the 2006 Senate immigration bill, and it found that $66 billion would be raised in taxes at the local, state, and federal level over 10 years. $66 billion. Second, immigration reform helps American workers and their wages. Reform eliminates the trapdoor that permits bad apple employers to hire undocumented workers, pay them less, and thereby lower and create an unlevel playing field for all workers. Third, reform rewards honest employers. With reform, we would restore the rule of law and we would have a legal workforce. Today's honest employers who are trying to follow the law are behind the eight ball when dishonest competitors hire undocumented workers, pay them less, and permit those bad guy employers to operate in the marketplace with a huge advantage. Finally, and then we'll turn to our speakers. Opponents on the other side are steadfast in their slogans, but they're short on their solutions. They demand that enforcing the law and deporting the 12 million will somehow be efficient. To date, the spending on enforcement has skyrocketed, and we know we have the largest number of undocumented people in our nation's history. And in fact, to deport these people, the Center for American Progress estimated that it would cost over $206 billion over 5 years, or $41 billion a year. In contrast, the entire DHS budget in 2008 was $47 million. So in these economic times, as we consider this major policy initiative, it would seem to only make sense that we should look at the economic impact of immigration reform and urge the administration to move forward on it. The following panelists will give you their perspectives on this important topic, and our first speaker is Dan Silano, and he's Executive Director of the Program in Law, Economics, and Business at Stanford Law School, and he's also the Associate Dean for the Executive Education and Programs at Stanford. Dan?
Thank you. I think what I'm going to do really for just about 3 minutes is give a very broad spectrum overview that in many ways I think helps us ask the right questions, the questions we mean to ask, and give some framing to this. So there are several foundational issues, but one of them is that the story, the narrative here is that the U.S. economy is not a fixed pie. It is a dynamic economy that grows and sadly at the moment shrinks depending on what's going on. And part of the theme here will be a lot of what drives this growing or lack of growth has to do with the middle class. And so this is critical. One of the questions we need to ask in the context of a program that legalizes undocumented workers and brings them into the fold, puts them in the above-ground economy is, does this grow the American economy pie? How does this help impact that economy so that all U.S. workers can share in a growing rather than shrinking, in a bigger rather than smaller pie? So first, let's highlight what this current recession has done to all workers, and that is it's increased uncertainty and created certain disincentives for investing. If you don't know if you're going to be able to afford your house, maybe you don't invest in making that house nice. If you don't know if you're going to have your job, you may or may not invest the time to improve your skills for that job. These problems are exaggerated and made worse if you're undocumented. This reduced uncertainty causes people not to invest in themselves, in their community, in their jobs, and in their skills. And we know that that investment, whether for documented, people here as U.S. workers, or undocumented, is very critical. We want to remove as much uncertainty and disincentives for this kind of investment, whether human capital, small business, or otherwise, as possible. And this type of a program, we know from experience and from analysis from the likes of the Drum Major Institute for Public Policy, their work on the middle class, we know that this reduces that uncertainty and helps grow the economy. Second category, and the last kind of broad point here, is that enfranchised consumers, consumers who are a part of the above-ground economy, are better consumers, meaning they are more willing to buy a home if they have certainty about their future and be able to live in that neighborhood, to live in this country, and to keep their job. They are more likely to invest extra effort and time and money into their children and into things that help them be a part of a community, whether it's buildings or businesses or cars. And absent that kind of certainty about the future, the likelihood of those important category of consumers, 12 million strong, spending more and growing the economy is reduced. And that's, you know, just bad economic strategy for our viewpoint. So in summary, boosting or stabilizing the middle class is what most of creating jobs is about. And we know that allowing people to enter the above-ground economy, to come into the fold, helps boost the middle class for all. And with respect to the notion that why can't we stabilize the U.S. worker middle class by simply swapping jobs, having those who are undocumented leave their jobs and instead allow those who are U.S. workers but unemployed take their jobs, and it is summed up in the notion that that's a fixed pie perspective. And if our solution is to give a bus ticket to a well-deserving but unemployed General Motors former worker and send him or her to California to pick vegetables, I think we will have done a genuine disservice to that individual and his or her family and the economy as a whole. The trick is to keep the people who will work hard and invest in the United States here still working hard so they might open businesses, grow restaurants, help their children become successful and be professionals when they themselves were not, those will help grow our economy and in turn provide retraining and job opportunities for that former GM worker. There's lots of other points, but I'll stop there so that we can get some other perspectives.
Great. Thanks, Dan. Our next speaker is David Kalik, and David is a senior fellow and the director of immigration research at the Fiscal Policy Institute. David?
Hi, thanks. Well, let me pick up by saying I think we've heard some people asking whether this is the right time for immigration reform. And I would say, you know, the idea of immigration reform isn't that we should have a higher rate of immigration than we have right now. It's that we should have a functioning system that regulates immigration. So that means, first of all, making sure that those people who come in the future come under a workable and enforceable immigration system. And second of all, that we create a pathway for gaining legal status for undocumented immigrants who are here today. Reform that leads to a better regulated immigration system can only be good in an economic downturn for a lot of the reasons that Dan was saying. I think what you sometimes hear is not just about immigration reform, but a kind of wishful thinking, like, what if undocumented immigrants just vanished? Wouldn't that mean that there would be jobs freed up for U.S.-born workers? You know, the thing is, people don't just vanish, and you know, just imagine what it would be involved in driving out an estimated 10 or 12 million undocumented immigrants. There would be tremendous disruption in businesses around the nation. Sure, U.S. foreign workers would get some of the jobs that might be vacated, but it's also very likely there would be fewer jobs to go around because businesses would be terribly disrupted at a very precarious time. I can't imagine business owners would appreciate the idea of mass deportation of their employees. It would be terrible for the economy. Probably more important, it's just not real. Mass deportation is just not going to happen. What is real, I think, is the idea of bringing undocumented immigrants into the above-ground economy and making sure that they pay taxes and receive benefits just like everyone else. The cost of the underground economy to taxpayers is pretty substantial. We looked at the Fiscal Policy Institute at the construction industry just in New York City, and we found that if you look at workers who were misclassified and workers who were working off the books, so not necessarily just undocumented workers, but workers who are misclassified and working off the books, $70 million in lost income tax revenues for New York City, state, and federal government, and $272 million in lost payroll taxes and insurance premiums like unemployment insurance and workers' compensation. So immigration reform on its own won't eliminate the underground economy, but immigration reform has to be part of the solution to eliminating the underground economy and not an obstacle to preventing that from happening.
Terrific. Thank you, David. Our next speaker is Esther Lopez, and Esther is the Director of Civil Rights and Community Action at the United Food and Commercial Workers International Union. Esther?
The UFCW represents 1.3 million workers in the U.S. and in Canada. We represent 250,000 workers in the meatpacking and the meat and food processing industries. Our union has a rich immigrant tradition. Packing houses have long been the starting point for immigrant families in the U.S. Our union has seen the impact of immigrant workers who have organized around improved wages and working conditions, and frankly, workers that are lifting the industry standards. Our union has been at the forefront of the flawed enforcement strategies of the Bush administration. Simply, meatpacking workers had a target, and we saw that in the SWIFT raids of 2006, where we witnessed the mass detention of thousands of workers. Our union filed a lawsuit against ICE and established a National Commission on ICE Misconduct to investigate the impact of enforcement practices that violate workers' rights. This workplace raids will go down as a dark period in our nation's history. We cannot enforce our way to a workable immigration system. We need comprehensive immigration reform. We saw at the in Postville, Iowa, at the agriprocessors meat plant, what happens when bad employers use the broken immigration system to drive down wages and working conditions. We have seen what happens when labor laws are not enforced. Comprehensive immigration reform is the only way where we can level the playing field for all workers. A system built on fear and intimidation to threaten and suppress the immigrant workforce hurts all workers. By bringing people out of the shadows, by having legalization be part of a broader comprehensive immigration reform, we can create an immigration system that works for the American worker. We need an immigration system that is part of our national economic recovery program, that ensures labor standards and allows workers to be full participants in our society. We need immigration reform that punishes employers who game the system to drive down wages and working conditions. Way too often, employers use immigration as a tool to suppress efforts by workers to organize their workplaces. Immigration is about much more than just who enters and leaves our country. Yes, it's about border security, but it's also about trade relations. It's about labor needs. It's about family unity. It's about legalization and worker rights and living standards. We cannot in this economy afford to leave 12 million undocumented individuals suspended at the edge of hope. We in labor are working together on a framework for comprehensive immigration reform. We'll meet with key congressional and administrative personnel to move immigration reform. We believe that a framework for immigration reform includes enhanced enforcement of labor laws, an earned legalization, a family unity program that is real, secure borders, an employment verification system that works and doesn't discriminate, reform that includes due process protections for immigrants, that includes welcoming and integrating immigrants into our society, bilateral relationships with sending countries, and reform that addresses the future flow of immigrant workers. For the UFCW and the broader labor movement, immigration reform is a top priority. We welcome the Obama administration's time now to move this issue. We believe it's the way to move and fix the economy. We don't believe that we can fix the economy without addressing immigration reform. We welcome having a Secretary of Labor who understands the intersection between labor and immigration issues. We do think this can be done. We're committed to making sure that it does get done and to work in coalition with our partners to get this done right and to solve a really important problem in this country, both for our economy and for families and at the workplace. Thank you.
Thank you, Esther. Our final speaker is Gerald Janes. Professor Janes is a professor of economics and professor of African American studies at Yale University.
I shall be brief. Several years ago, I was convinced that immigrants significantly lower native wages and their employment. Subsequently, my statistical analyses forced me to conclude otherwise. In addition, a review of other rigorous analyses of the effects of immigration on American or native-born workers, including the less educated, suggests that the effects are negative but relatively small, in fact quite small, and in any event secondary to other causes of particularly less educated workers' dismal employment and wage experiences. Now, there are many opponents of immigration and immigrants who cite selective statistics to argue the opposite, but that's precisely the point. They are using very selective statistics that often aren't even saying what they are claiming for them. When one reviews the analyses that have been done by the individuals who have no particular political axes to grind and who have been put through peer review processes for publications by research institutions in academia or in the research periodicals of various disciplines such as economics and sociology, one overwhelmingly finds that the findings of immigrants on effects on employment and wages of the native-born are either small, non-existent, and in some cases actually are positive, that is, bringing in a large number of lower-educated immigrant workers is often seen to be complementary to native-born workers, that is, immigrants can actually create jobs. Secondly, reform itself, immigration reform, is, I agree wholeheartedly with the previous speaker, is very likely to improve the condition of not only the immigrant workers, particularly the undocumented workers who are currently here, but also the native-born workers. Because one of the major problems, and I've studied and written about this in particular, for native-born workers of low education and skill, is that they are competing against undocumented workers who employers are, in fact, exploiting and taking advantage of. So to eliminate exploitation for the undocumented, in effect, eliminates or at least minimizes to a great degree exploitation in American labor markets for all of the participants. So there is actually going to be a gain from immigration reform if there is a clear path towards citizenship for undocumented workers. Now I'll conclude with that.
Thank you, Professor Janes. Ross, could you give instructions to the participants on how they might ask a question?
Thank you. And at this time, if you would like to register to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touchtone phone. Keep in mind that you may remove yourself from the question queue at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, to register to ask a question, please press the star 1 keys now. We will pause momentarily to give everyone an opportunity to queue. And we will take our first question from the side of Mr. Stuart Powell of the Houston Chronicle. Go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. Thanks very much for doing this. It just seems that the arguments you're posing essentially go against the historical record, which shows that in hard economic times, people turn against immigrants. I wonder if you could sort of walk us through the politics of this, how you see overcoming that issue as this issue comes before the Congress.
Well, this is Angie. I can start on that. I think that the politics actually speak very much in favor of moving this issue. I mean, you know, starting back in November, there was a game changer where the electoral map changed dramatically from red to blue in key states like Nevada, New Mexico, Colorado, and Florida, in no small part because of the turnout by Latino voters. And an issue that is forefront for them is immigration reform. Now, Latinos, like everybody else, care about the economy and education and health care, but frankly, a disqualifier for them is how this issue is engaged by politicians. And we've seen where in 22 competitive races in the House and the Senate, where immigration was engaged in a negative anti-way, only two of those races did the restrictionist Republican win. In 20 of those races where Democrats engaged the issue, they leaned into the issue, and they said we need to solve this precisely because of our nation's security issues and because of our economic challenges, that's the person who prevailed. So I think the political dynamics have changed dramatically in just the last few years, as are the demographics of the country. And I also think that the American public would be shocked that this issue would remain unresolved. And there is nothing to be gained by keeping 12 million people living in the shadows and by having the billions of dollars that we have in enforcement going to keeping 12 million people in that situation and more people coming in the future. And the economic arguments that the folks have laid out so well today, I think, would also argue that we're foolish to not pursue this agenda. Are there other speakers who'd like to chime in?
I'm just on David Kalik. I mean, I think it's certainly been true that frequently in the past an economic downturn prompts an anti-immigrant reaction, but I think immigration reform is not about being pro-immigrant or anti-immigrant. It's about having a system that functions. And I think that there's, you know, that makes the current situation a very good time to try to address what I think everybody recognizes as a broken system.
Yeah, this is Dan. I also might just add also that I think though it's a bit politically uphill, to focus on the mid to long term is important and just keep asking the question, what do we really want? We want an economy that grows stronger and creates jobs, and what is it that helps do that? Well, you know, for example, Latino buying power has almost quadrupled in the last 15 years, and a significant component of that does in fact come from undocumented workers. So that adds to the economy. Plus, we want people who work hard and fill important components of the economy to continue to do that in a way that is above ground, so that businesses that cheat, you know, are held to account and that the system works better. I think we can't imagine a scenario in which the economy never recovers and it truly is a fixed pie. If that's one's view, that strikes me as very un-American. If, on the other hand, you believe that we'll eventually come out of this and do better, we should plan for that now.
Can I just follow this with another question?
Sure.
Do you think there's anything the Obama administration can do to document the value of the sort of the underground economy that would theoretically come to light if we went forward with immigration reform? Are there any studies or anything that they could use to sort of overcome the very issues we're talking about?
Yeah, there is some research underway on that that isn't quite complete, but that will be rolled out in the coming weeks and months. And I also think, look, you can look back on the CBO score of the 06 and 07 Senate bills, right? So in 06, there was, 60, what was the figure I gave you guys? $66 billion that would be raised in taxes if we legalized people. In 07, I think the figure was $48 billion in taxes that would be raised if we legalized folks over the next 10 years. So we have some analysis that's already been done. We have the economic analysis that you've heard today, and that's captured in IPC's report, and we have more that's coming.
I think you can look back, David Kalik again, you can look back as well on what happened after the 1986 reforms when what you saw was, and this is in the report that the IPC sent around to everybody, you know, the wages were increased very significantly in the years following the legalization then. I think that's very predictable. In fact, I think a big part of what the Congressional Budget Office is estimating is going to be the advantage of some form of legalization also is that you have more opportunity and more and more incentive to improve your skills and climb up a clear career ladder. If you're an undocumented immigrant, it's in fact, I mean, sort of as Dan was saying, it's a very un-American position where you're not able to advance. And I think that if you if you have more opportunity to advance, then you're also going to be contributing more fully.
This is Angie. I just should note that on our website, which is immigrationpolicy.org, the report should be on the website by now. So apologies if you haven't already gotten that or seen it.
And we'll take our next question from the side of Mr. Robert Samuelson of Newsweek. Please go ahead. Mr.
Hello?
Robert Samuelson, please go ahead, sir.
The thrust of the way you describe immigration reform is mainly to have a path to legalization for the illegals who are now here. But what, if anything, do you support so that we don't get in this situation again? I mean, we had immigration reform in 86, and that was mm-hmm. supposed to take care of it. It didn't. And so I guess my question is, what would you propose so that the immigration reform of 2009 is really the last one that has to deal in a major way with illegal immigration, and that the future immigration reforms will deal with just the nature of legal immigration?
That's a great question, and this is Angie, and I'll get it started. So here are the flaws in 86. 86 said that if you were here as of a certain day in January 1st, 1982, that you could qualify to get legalized. If you came after that date, you were out of luck. So there were a lot of people that were already in the U.S. that were never eligible. Secondly, the bill from 1986 pretended that no more people would come in the future. It created an employer sanctions framework, which required employers, as they still have to now, to fill out an I-9 form, to look at documents when they're going to hire somebody, that if they prove facially valid, then you get the green light and you can get the job. And clearly that's been a complete failure. The 1986 law didn't anticipate that there would be a future flow of immigrants coming to this country, and the 1986 employer sanctions framework completely failed because it really left it up to the employer to decide whether or not the documents were valid. So what's being discussed now, many years later, with technology just providing a lot more by way of options, is that we would have an electronic employer verification system where an employer faced with an applicant would run that information through and would be told through a government database whether or not that person is eligible to work. So it wouldn't be a decision that the employer would be getting to make, but it would be based on when we would need to have reliable data and databases that are over time implemented so we can be sure that the person that's in front of you is a person who's eligible to work. But we're in a very different place now in 2009 than we were in 1986. On the question of people coming in the future, we have very few immigrant visas for low-skilled workers. Annually, there are only 5,000 visas that are available. This is a time where, frankly, we don't need a lot of new workers. And again, it's opportune for assessing what would be the right number, what would be an accurate labor market analysis, rather than a static number, which is what we have now, which is obviously way too low, so that we can determine how many people do we actually need to fill needed jobs so that we're not displacing American workers. So those two components, electronic verification system and really an accurate assessment, and Esther, perhaps you can speak to this because I know UFCW has been thinking about it, so that we're bringing in a needed number of workers rather than some arbitrary number, which is what we have today. Would other speakers like to pipe up?
Carol James, I think that the question was a very good one, and what it really gets to is the following, that the American polity needs an overall consensus on the number of immigrants that are going to be flowing into the country and what the status of those immigrants is actually going to be, whether they're going to be first or second class residents, and that has a three-tier set of conditions. The first is that the undocumented who are here need to be given a pathway to legalization for the reasons that we've been discussing, which is going to be helpful not only to the undocumented themselves, but also to overall labor market conditions and therefore the conditions of the native-born workers, and also for the reputation of the American political and economic labor market system itself. Then secondly, we need to restructure and enforce employer sanctions, because no one here is arguing that we just have a continuous open door policy for anyone to come into the country under any conditions. And thirdly, these future flows have to be restructured. But all of these things really need to be done in a coordinated way, because each one of them is a piece of a whole system or whole problem.
Esther, do you have anything to add, or Dan or David?
I would just reiterate what Professor James says, is that there are interconnected methods that need to be implemented. Border security, border control is one of them. Employer verification is another. We really need to look at how at temporary worker programs that exist now, and we need a really important method to adjust how we bring workers in the future.
Next question, Ross.
And we'll take our next question from the side of Moira Herbst of Business Week.
Hi, it's Moira Herbst. This discussion is largely about unskilled and undocumented workers. I wondered if anyone on the panel could talk about skilled workers. I'd be interested, first of all, to know if there are new economic studies that, say, Gerald Chains has about those workers, as well as if someone could comment on politically how the skilled portion of the comprehensive reform is likely to play out.
Dan or David, any comments on the economic reform in the context of high skilled?
I'm happy to make, this is Dan, just a couple of comments on this. One, it's ironic, right now on Forum on KQED, NPR, they're doing a session on the relatively low initial usage of H-1Bs in this economy for this current cycle. And I think it is, therefore, when we talk about skilled workers, comparable to what we're thinking about in terms of normalizing under comprehensive immigration reform, even unskilled workers. And that is to say, we must ask the question, what does the economy need if our goal is to improve it for everybody? And it obviously doesn't need the same thing year in, year out, cycle up, cycle down. And so I think that the direction that skilled worker comprehensive immigration reform must go, if we're smart about it, is to calibrate who we let in, why we let them in, and for how long, to what our best guesses are dynamically about the economy. And at least from my view, and maybe I'm biased because I sit here in Silicon Valley, it is clear to me that we want to strategically admit and hopefully retain for the long term, frankly, not just on a short-term basis under H-1B, the very best and the brightest and the highly skilled. And who that is in any given year might fluctuate a bit, and we'll have to be clever and creative about doing that, whether it's, you know, some sort of point system used in other places or, frankly, something that a bunch of smart people, I hope, can come together and figure out under comprehensive immigration reform in the coming months.
I could maybe just add that I think it's very important to look at the whole range of immigration and to understand it as of a piece. So I think you're right to be thinking about some of the people at the more skilled end of the spectrum, and in fact, you know, also quite important entrepreneurs and people in the middle of the spectrum as well. But I think at the very high end, we see here in New York City, the Partnership for New York issuing a big report, very concerned about what's happening with H-1B visas and what the effect is going to be on some of the high-end industries in New York City. After Silicon Valley, I think, is probably the biggest place where H-1B visas are being used. And I think, you know, when we look at upstate New York, or we've been looking at the 25 largest metro areas in the country, it's interesting that what you see in even in places where there's very comparatively low immigration overall is that it's not only at the very skilled end, but also in certain occupations that you see a big concentration of immigrants. Among doctors, engineers, in research and development, in higher education very frequently. So I think that the more skilled immigrants are a very important piece of the overall immigration picture. And I think, I guess I would also caution a little bit against the idea that we should just, you know, we sometimes hear what we really want is kind of just the more skilled people, and let's kind of, you know, let's skew things more that way. I think that it's clear also that you have to have a climate that's welcoming for those skilled workers, and that in some of the areas, like we've seen this a little bit out in Long Island, when you start to create a very anti-immigrant atmosphere, or if you don't have immigration policies to let people come and go easily, for example, or there's lots of stuff happening at the airport that feels intimidating, it may be that creates a problem that that puts off some of the more highly skilled immigrants that you, in fact, want to be able to make sure that you're getting the best and the brightest from all around the world.
May I throw in one additional thing, which is we shouldn't forget that the U.S.-born children of these 12 million undocumented individuals that we're talking about are also the long-term U.S.-born skilled immigrant or skilled workforce. I mean, I say that because there is a generational advantage that if we can create certainty among the undocumented workforce by making them documented, by bringing them into the fold, we know both anecdotally and empirically that the children of immigrants are more likely to be entrepreneurial, in certain circumstances become high attainers in academics, and frankly, from that cohort will emerge some of the disruptive innovators of our next generation, and we risk now losing out on that generation of tremendously skilled and creative and contributory U.S.-born U.S. citizens if we continue to create this tremendous uncertainty for their parents.
Gerald James, let me just add that there are two moral dimensions to this, the problem of the number of skilled workers. Skilled immigrants we should be taking in. The first is what they used to call in economics the brain drain problem. That is, I personally believe there is a moral problem with taking, let's just use an example, taking medical doctors from lower income countries, medical doctors and nurses. But then secondly, there's a second moral problem, and that's concerned with it cuts off the will to attempt to provide incentives and to improve the domestic pipeline of educated and skilled workers among disadvantaged native populations.
Are there any more questions?
And we'll take our next question from the side of Suzanne Gamboa of the Associated Press. Please go ahead.
Just a quick question for Gerald. There have been so many reports that come out about the economic benefits of immigrants and the economic disadvantages of immigrants, and it seems like there's never a consensus to the point that I often kind of just dismiss a lot of it because it seems like there's no agreement really, and just depends on what side of the coin you're coming from. I think even this week there's going to be another news conference by a group about the EITC refunds and how that costs. So I'm interested in what it was from you was the kicker that really turned you around. You talked about statistical analysis, and maybe that's something I need to get from you later. But I really would like to know if there's a single report or a certain type of research that was done or a certain type of numbers you looked at that made you a believer that immigrants actually benefit the economy as opposed to hurt it.
Okay, well, let me say, I actually think there is a consensus. There are what we might call gatherings of consensus. I would put these studies that are cited, quoted, done into two groups. We obviously have people who are in some particular political camp who maybe do a study or pay for a study, and they get what they're paying for. And those studies tend to say come up with conclusions which you would have guessed in the first place. But there are individuals involved in certain research institutions and in academia who are going at this question, and they really want to know what's the answer, and they don't have any particular, as I said before, axe to grind. Now, what put me over, as I alluded to in my introductory remarks, was that I in the mid-90s felt that, in particular, lower-skilled African-American men and women were being hurt by immigration, but just simply on the basis of, textbook elementary economic supply and demand, and also observations of construction workers in certain cities across the United States. But I didn't simply let it go at that. I and a colleague at the University of Wisconsin, a sociologist, obtained some grant money, and we did a statistical analysis of the United States where we tried to sort these things out. And what we were able to find, what we came up with was that overall, with respect to the employment status and the wage status, looking at broad categories of ethnic and racial groups as well as blue-collar versus white-collar workers, that there were pretty much no effects except for the lowest-skilled blue-collar workers, and those effects were quite negligible. Now, I must also say that because we had started doing that study with the opposite belief, we didn't simply stop when we got that result. We subjected the model and the statistics to many separate kinds of tests and reformulations to make sure that that was correct. And I think that when you're looking at research that's coming out of academia and that's been paid for by, say, the National Science Foundation or one of the larger, more philanthropic institutes, which doesn't have any particular point of view that they're trying to put forth, that there is quite a large consensus that that is the result, that there are, for less educated or less skilled workers, negative effects on employment and wages, particularly for African Americans and for native-born Latinos, but that those are in fact much smaller than one than the numbers that one gets, for example, if you listen to the other kinds of sources.
And we'll take our next question from the side of Ms. Leslie Froelich of Mundo Hispanico. Please go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. This kind of goes along with the last question. I'm just curious if there's any sort of research or any sort of data that can back up many who oppose, quote-unquote, illegal immigration or immigration reform will cite statistics about the millions of dollars that are sent back to Latin America in remittances from immigrants working in the United States, or millions of dollars, quote-unquote, that immigrants exploit in using, United States social services. Do you guys have any sort of data or reports that might, counteract those viewpoints that might support the fact that, yes, some of that money is going out of the country, or yes, immigrants might use social services, but at the end of the day, the money that is brought in by their working and their spending power overrides that. Do you guys have any sort of data that would prove that?
Well, let's start with remittances first. Do any of the panelists have a reaction to that as remittances is a bad thing?
Well, I think, this is David Kallick, remittances is certainly part of the equation that anybody looking serious, anybody doing a serious study about the economic impacts, that'll be part of the way that you think about what's going on. I think it's, and some of that I think is what, what Professor James, to my mind, is sort of the counter side of that moral argument is this is actually our biggest economic development assistance to developing countries. It's part of what immigration looks like. It's part of the reason people come, and then, of course, they establish themselves and very often stay and advance and benefit the U.S. economy. So I think it is part of the picture. I don't think it by any means makes that into a negative, it doesn't turn a negative thing into a positive. It's just part of the overall picture.
And in fact, this is Dan. I just want to add, there are several studies, and we can probably pull them up and post them or something, but remittances have a recycling multiplier effect, and remittances, particularly those by Latinos sent back to countries like Mexico, which constitutes a large portion of overall remittances, are oftentimes recycled in purchasing power, which in turn advantages, U.S.-based or partially U.S.-based corporations. It isn't, again, a fixed pie, and that multiplier effect is magnified by the relatively well-thought, and consistent stability that results by certain types of remittances which stabilize emerging countries' middle class. So again, I think remittances, not just from a foreign policy development viewpoint, but just from a pure economic recycling viewpoint, are generally a positive thing. And it's not leaving the U.S. economy. It's kind of visiting another economy and coming back often.
All right. And then on the question of benefits, do the speakers have any comments? I can chime in if others don't. So this is a charge that we often hear, that somehow immigrants, undocumented immigrants, have access to lots of benefit programs, which in fact isn't the case. The majority of immigrants aren't eligible to receive public benefits like Medicaid or TANF or SSI or any of those. I mean, undocumented immigrants are eligible for emergency medical care and their children for K-12, you know, public education. And frankly, that's really about it. And if a legal immigrant is here and is trying to sponsor a family member, a close family member, then they have to show, and they have to file an affidavit of support. They have to show that they have an income sufficient to support that immigrant. The immigrant that comes in also isn't eligible for any kind of benefit until they've worked in the U.S. for at least 10 years. So there aren't, you know, free handouts to people. And in fact, it would, you know, make a lot of sense to have these people be able to come out of the shadows so that they could not only earn more money, as we've discussed, but, you know, also have access to health care and, you know, those sorts of pieces that would make it easier for them and would, I think, have a positive financial impact.
Angie, this is Dan. May I point out that the big numbers often obtained by those who try to characterize immigrant consumption of social services as large are somewhat disingenuously cobbled together by citing public education as the source of quote-unquote consumption and expenditure. And the obvious, most kind of disturbing problem with that is that many of those are U.S. citizens. They just happen to be in a family or a household that has a head of household who's undocumented, and yet the individual, the child consuming the school, is in fact a U.S. citizen. And the second disingenuous part is that, you know, kids and sometimes much older people, they tend to, at a fiscal level, consume more resources than they contribute. But particularly for children and also for older people in different contexts, we're happy to do that as a society because in the end, they're the folks who end up growing our economy later. So it's really quite disingenuous at two levels sometimes.
Good point. And IPC also has a fact sheet, which we'll put back on our website, that looked at some studies that were done, in particular a 2003 California Health Interview Survey that found that in terms of emergency medical care, that undocumented immigrants and other undocumented Latinos reported less use of that than their U.S.-born counterparts.
There is another study that the State of Illinois Department of Human Service conducted about 2 years ago that again shows the use of any state programs was less among immigrants than it was significantly less among immigrants than native-born or Illinois residents. That was done by the Department of Human Services in the state of Illinois.
Great. Thank
right.
you.
Gerald James here. What this really just goes to show is that opponents can't really have it both ways. They kind of contradict themselves. They can't argue that immigrants are coming here and working real hard and are fully employed practically and are hurting native-born jobs, but then also argue that they're on welfare, et cetera.
Is there another question? I think we have time for just one or two more.
Yes. We'll take our next question from the side of Mr. Art Raymond. Please go ahead, sir.
Good afternoon. Thanks for the discussion. I was hoping the panel might weigh in on what a large-scale legalization policy would look like, maybe talk about some of the nuts and bolts.
Sure. This is Angie. I can get us started. A legalization program would have a number of requirements. It would have a cutoff day, so people in the U.S. as of a certain day would be eligible, and I would argue that it should include as many people here as possible. Among the requirements would be that folks be required to come forward, that they would have to pay taxes, including back taxes, that they would have to show that they're learning English, they would have to be free of any kind of serious criminal record. It may be that they have to show that they're currently employed or at least have a recent employment history. So those would be just some of the requirements coming forward. And, you know, obviously they would have to be, you know, very tough security screening by the Department of Homeland Security. Is that what you meant?
you. And we'll take our next question from the side of Mr. Mike Swift of the San Jose Mercury. Please go ahead.
I think this is sort of a question for Dan, but what you were saying earlier about how the children of immigrants tend to be more entrepreneurial, and that's going to contribute to innovation in the future. Does that pertain to lower-income immigrants as well, or are you really talking more about more highly educated ones?
Sure. Let me tackle that. It clearly and pretty unequivocally pertains to higher-skilled immigrants, just because we've paid a lot of attention and studied that consistently, and we know from our experience in Silicon Valley and other places, for example, more than half of all successful startups have had as a part of their founding team someone who benefited from an H-1B, as a commonly cited result of a study that was sponsored by the Kauffman Foundation. However, on the lesser skilled, I think one of the things we can't do, at least in my observation in immigration policy, is magically sort for those individuals who will be the most contributory and the most wonderful and the most innovative. Human capital just doesn't work that way, and we're foolish to not imagine the scenario in which, the son or daughter, whether U.S. born or undocumented but later legalized, of the housekeeper and the groundskeeper goes on in Silicon Valley to be inspired and well-educated and founds the next version of whatever it may be, a Google, a Facebook, or otherwise. So I think that our sense of unskilled innovators who go on to be entrepreneurial, let's not forget the economy is not just built on the backs of Googles and Intels, but rather on hundreds of thousands of individuals who run small restaurants, run small landscaping services, have florists and delivery services, and any number of vocations that are small business and don't end up being publicly traded but are nonetheless very important. From the ranks of the undocumented workers, those entrepreneurs emerge, and we know that based on Census Bureau data and other data, and to not bring them into the fold is truly to make it less worthwhile for them to put their time and their capital at risk to grow our economy by employing, ironically, other people, many of them U.S. workers.
Yeah, if I could add to David Kalik, I think that immigrants come here obviously with tremendous drive and also a belief in America as a place where they're going to be able to do better. I think that when you're talking about some of the commercial strips that are having trouble getting businesses going, or some of the cities, I'm thinking of Buffalo or Pittsburgh, or where you have underpopulated downtowns and the need for somebody to come in and start some businesses and commit to the schools and get things going again. I think that the idea, if immigrants have traditionally done that, and we've seen the results of that in lots of parts of the country, I think that's, of course, not going to be the PhDs and the people who come in at the very high end of the economy. It's going to be people who come here believing that they have a chance to start a store, they want to have a restaurant, they want to have a small business that's going to then eventually grow. And I think that that's what's revived commercial strips and downtowns in lots of parts of the U.S. And, that clearly, although we don't have data that can necessarily document it exactly, and as Dan's saying, we can't pre-select those people. I think it's clear that that's where that energy comes from among immigrants, and that's where there's potential for, I think, that kind of growth. That's very, very important for the economy and for local areas around the country.
And David, the one takeaway point is that if you think that there is a risk that maybe your wife or you will be caught up in something and your life here will be abruptly ended through deportation or otherwise, you're just, and we know this, it makes common sense, and we've observed it empirically, you're less likely to cobble together your entire life savings and perhaps your brother's savings and your cousin's savings and do something with that requires that you be here. That uncertainty is a profound and unambiguous impediment to people taking risks to grow the economy by starting businesses and innovating, even at that, in fact, maybe more so at that straightforward, let's start a restaurant, let's start a dry cleaner level.
Sure, and in fact, I think if I add one more thing in that, I mean, if you think a place like Riverside, New Jersey, where they, where they actually passed a bunch of undocumented immigrant laws, they found that the whole commercial downtown area kind of closed up, and it wasn't necessarily undocumented immigrants who were there. It's just that you create an anti-immigrant atmosphere, and it can be very destructive to businesses.
Terrific. Operator, I think we'll take one last question since we started a few minutes after the hour, and then we'll wrap up.
We'll take our next question from Mr. Edward Cifuentes of the North County Times. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you. And there is a ballot measure that just entered circulation here in California. It's very similar to 187 denying public benefits to the children of undocumented immigrants, even those who were born here, not giving them birth certificates, for example, or a different kind of certificate than you would give a normal kid. And I wonder if you could comment on these kinds of efforts and the potential for more of these kinds of things to create a backlash against immigrants in this kind of an economy.
So, Edward, just to be sure we understand, it's a proposed ballot initiative that targets the children of undocumented immigrants.
Correct.
So, in other words, it targets U.S. citizens.
Correct.
Okay. Do any of the speakers have an initial reaction to that?
Well, in some ways, I guess it follows on what I was just saying. I think we've seen, Riverside, New Jersey comes to mind as the most obvious case that I know about, but where these measures that were intended largely to be, to discourage immigrants from being there, you know, that they weren't necessarily well-crafted or well thought through what exactly they were doing, but they're intended to make it uncomfortable for immigrants to be there, succeeded in pushing away a lot of immigrants and also a lot of families who just in general felt uncomfortable with that atmosphere. And that was, you know, from an economic standpoint, a real problem, enough of a problem that within, I think, a year, they turned those around and decided that it was a mistake to go in that direction because, you know, they saw boarded up stores all across downtown Riverside.
This is Dan. I should just highlight. So first, you know, it has a constitutional problem, I think. It violates the 14th Constitution, 14th Amendment. And secondly, at a practical level, it strikes me as catastrophically kind of un-American. I think it's fairly foundational that if you are born here in the United States, that unambiguously you're going to be a U.S. citizen, and that allows you to make certain decisions, which frankly are good for everyone moving forward. And I should point out just a simple potential complication, which is, as we know, status at any given moment in the United States, if you are not a U.S. citizen, is something, sadly, that can be debated. Even if you believe you are lawfully here, there is a risk that you aren't. And I would hate to see a very Orwellian, frightening future in which, you know, a U.S. citizen who now is important, disruptive, contributing, but has enemies, let's say, then go and investigate whether or not maybe we can characterize their parent status as undocumented at that time. The ballot initiative as written would then retroactively strip that person's U.S. citizenship away. I can't imagine making a story that sounds more Orwellian. So I think it is the backlash. It's not something that's going to create the backlash. This is the backlash. And sadly, I think it does color what is a positive potential story for immigrants. And hopefully it'll just be a footnote.
I would just like to add that these types of state and local initiatives really cry for comprehensive immigration reform. We cannot become a nation of 9 million ordinances that reflect a disjointed and dysfunctional policy. We need comprehensive immigration reform to address these issues, and we need the federal government to have jurisdiction over immigration reform. We cannot become a county side by side implementing different immigration. That's just not workable for workers. It's not workable for families. These types of initiatives cry for comprehensive immigration reform.
I'm just flipping through my papers here because of the case in San Jose. But Justice Brennan said when you know there was a Supreme Court case that decided the right of the children of undocumented immigrants to attend public schools, and what he wrote was, it's difficult to understand precisely what the state hopes to achieve by promoting the creation and perpetuation of a subclass of illiterates within our boundaries. I mean, it seems like it's a crazy idea to take people who are here already and, in fact, you know, who are the kind of hope for the future that Dan is talking about and to somehow consign them into a very marginal, even more marginal status than they are already.
Well, I think on that note, this is Angela Kelly. I'm going to thank the speakers for their terrific participation. If folks would like to call my office, if you didn't get called on and you would like to, you can please give me a call. I can be reached at 202-507-7511, and I can put you in touch with any of the speakers. I'd like to thank the speakers. Please check our website, immigrationpolicy.org, for the report, and thanks, everybody, for participating today.